Washington throws the toys out of the pram today, Tuesday, October 1st. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Today, a Brit helps us understand what's happening here in the U.S.
It feels like America is feeling a bit more like Italy, in a permanent state of legislative governmental crisis, a kind of standoff that is perpetual.
We'll also hear from foreign tourists who've come a long way to visit our national park sites, but now can't. And later, Israel's prime minister tells the UN to distrust Iran.
Ahmadinejad was a wolf in wolf's clothing. Rouhani is a wolf in sheep's clothing. A wolf who thinks he can pull the eyes, the wool over the eyes, of the international community.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It didn't take long today to see the first signs, even outside Washington. Here in Boston, for example, there were plenty of placards with these words on them: because of the federal government shutdown, all national parks are closed. And we start our program today just outside Boston's historic Faneuil Hall. Private guides in tri-cornered hats are still working there, telling their tour groups about the American Revolution, but they had to do so today without access to the visitor center. Philip Draber, a tourist from Perth, Australia, wasn't too happy about that.
I just think it's appalling. Not my circumstances, but all the government employees. The fact that it's probably very disruptive if you're a business relying on government to do certain things. I'm not sure how your schools and your universities and all that, or just the multiplier effect of the machinery of government not actually working because, you know, it hasn't got the money to keep going. It's, I mean, say, as much as you believe in capitalism and free enterprise in this country, and you also need good governance.
German tourist Marcel Bernhardt was more sympathetic about the shutdown, and he couldn't help relating it to Europe's fiscal problems.
The European point of view, it's something like that. Okay, oh, the Americans, it's always the same with these guys. But I think our problems are not so different than yours are.
And a few miles down Boston's Freedom Trail at the Charlestown Navy Yard, where the USS Constitution is docked, tour guide Jane Greenhood was fuming on behalf of the group of French tourists who had to make do with seeing the ship from behind a fence.
They're quite désespérés. They're absolutely furious and devastated because this is just the beginning of their tour directly from France here to Boston today, and they're met by the strike.
Yes, she called it a strike because perhaps that's a more familiar term for the French than shutdown.
Mais dire que un pays comme les États-Unis, c'est pas normal que tout le pays se mette en grève.
Of course.
Nous Français, il y en a un sur deux ou un sur trois, on arrive à maintenir.
The United States, who would ever think that it would come to a complete close? In France, of course, they're accustomed to an occasional strike. It's part of the growing pains of a country. But no, this is absolutely unacceptable as far as they're concerned. Unacceptable.
You too can see some of Boston's famous landmarks from behind the fence. We've got a slideshow at PRI.org. And while you're there, tell us how the shutdown is affecting your travel plans. Add your thoughts at PRI.org. The partial shutdown of our federal government is the news story here in the U.S., of course, but it's also fodder for a lot of international news coverage. Gary Young is a feature writer and columnist for the British newspaper The Guardian. He's a Brit, but he's also based here in the U.S. for many years, currently in Chicago. So he's got a unique perspective on what's going on in Washington right now. I asked him earlier for his reaction to the shutdown.
It feels like America is feeling a bit more like Italy in terms of how it governs itself or doesn't govern itself.
So, and what does that mean?
Well, in a permanent state of legislative governmental crisis, a kind of standoff that is perpetual. And that, I mean, my personal take on it is that the Republicans are upset. It's a kind of display of their resistance and their impotence, actually, an acknowledgement that there's really nothing that they can do about it but throw the toys out of the pram, which is what it looks like.
And Brits must see that, and they see the government shutdown back when Clinton was president, and phrases like fiscal cliff, sequester, government shutdown. I mean, all this drama, what do they make of it?
Brits are familiar with American politics. They can name the American president in a way that most Americans couldn't name the British president, for example. There isn't really a keen understanding of how American government works. And so the extent to which the president is described as the president of the free world but can't almost literally make his trains run on time, then people wonder, well, how can this be? Beyond that, there is a weariness. It feels like America has been living on the edge of some kind of cliff, shutdown, debt ceiling, for a couple of years now. And there is a sense that somehow this would have been settled by the election, and that's what the election was about.
People know the country's dysfunctional governments quite well. What is distinctive about the American dysfunction right now?
The degree to which it sits in stark contradiction to America's self-image. I mean, first of all, Greece really did fall off a cliff. Italy ballets around cliffs habitually and has done so for a long time. And there is a sense in both Greece and Italy of the world has a sense of dysfunctional government. No, if you were looking for a model for good government, you wouldn't look to Greece and Italy. The Greeks and the Italians don't generally suggest that they're the greatest country in the world and have a model which other people should follow. And they don't claim to be the leaders of the free world.
But your point is that the United States does.
The United States claims a level of supremacy, functionality, leadership, which is severely undermined by a perpetual series of self-inflicted crises where the root of those crises are difficult to fathom. For most Europeans, certainly, was, why wouldn't you want healthcare? Why would this? Well, one of my friends wrote to me from England and said, what have Americans got against antibiotics? You know, and so the notion that not even universal healthcare would be the flashpoint for this crisis is difficult for people to grasp.
What do your readers make of that? Because today, of course, is the day that the Affordable Care Act, or otherwise known as Obamacare, comes into effect. Does that kind of muddy the waters even more for your British readers who have this pretty amazing national health care system? And how do they see, you know, that whole discussion?
National health service is one of those things, although Brits will routinely complain about it, they will also stoutly defend it against any notion that it would ever be gotten rid of. It's the one thing Thatcher couldn't touch. And so there was some sense that this argument had been won.
Gary, you're the Guardian's man in the U.S., more of a feature writer, been here for about 10 years. You meet Americans, you write about this country and kind of interpret it for the U.K. Why do you do the job you do?
I was actually trained as an interpreter, funnily enough.
Really?
Yes. Growing up black in Britain, as my parents are from Barbados and I was born in Britain, there's a sense in which I've always felt an outsider. And so speaking foreign languages, having that kind of anthropology, foreign languages both literally and metaphorically, is actually kind of part of who I am.
Wow.
And that there is something about relaying the language of a country, not literally the language of a country, but finding someone who is a liberal who loves guns, finding someone who's a conservative who is pro-immigration, finding a country's story is always more complex than the stereotypes. Not because the stereotypes don't exist, but because they are only part of the story.
Well, Gary Young, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Gary Young is a columnist for the British newspaper The Guardian. His latest book is The Speech, the story behind Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream. As Gary mentioned a few minutes ago, the political meltdown in Washington brings to mind the dysfunctional politics of Italy. And in fact, the Italian government is potentially facing its own sort of shutdown this week. Reporter Megan Williams in Rome, we're talking two different types of government shutdowns, really. I can only keep my head on so many shutdowns at once. So what are the broad contours of what's going on in Italy this week?
Well, what's basically happened is the government is being held hostage by Silvio Berlusconi, who, of course, is the controversial former prime minister of Italy. He, on Friday, he decided to pull his five ministers out of the cabinet. Now, it's a coalition cabinet. It's been a contentious cabinet. It's been fragile. So it wasn't strong to begin with, but it was composed of two different parties, the left and the right. And Berlusconi basically said, okay, enough of this. I'm going to pull out my support because he wants the government to fall. Why? Because at the end of this week, there was a Senate vote scheduled to consider banning him from public office for 6 years. This was after his recent tax fraud conviction. So this whole crisis was brought about by Berlusconi trying to save his political future.
How's he still kind of being able to kind of broker power?
You know, Berlusconi, for a few years now, has been like that outfit in your closet that you bought 20 years ago. It was really expensive and it seemed really glamorous and risque, and it would make good things happen in your life. But as the years go by, you realize that it was kind of cheap and a little tacky, but you just couldn't bring yourself to throw it away because it costs so much. Well, Italians are now ready to throw it away. They're sick of him. He's just turned 77. He is not offering anything new. People just want him gone. They want to focus on the two main problems right now, reforming the economy and reforming the electoral law, so that when people go to the polls, one party can emerge and actually govern Italy, as opposed to these coalitions that just fight and fall, you know, every few years.
It sounds like, you know, Italy's political parties, they've got different names, left Democratic Party and the center right People of Freedom Party. But it kind of sounds like Republicans and Democrats not able to reach political compromise. Am I right?
Yes. And in fact, Enrico Letta, the prime minister, said as the crisis began, he said he feels like he's trapped inside the film Groundhog Day, that it just keeps going around and around. And, you know, the players don't even change that much. I mean, there's a little shifting as to who leads the government. But for the most part, it's the same old characters that are just recycled through a very similar scenario.
I mean, I get the sense here that Americans are seriously frustrated with the antics of politicians. How about Italians? Also frustrated with theirs?
Terribly frustrated. I mean, people don't have that much money right now. That's part of it. And, you know, I think the most tragic thing about this situation continuing so long in Italy is the younger generation. There's a 40% unemployment rate amongst young people right now. And when you say young people in Italy, that doesn't mean, 21-year-old, 22-year-olds. It generally means people who are close to 40. I mean, these are people who are bright, creative, who have never had a real full-time job in their mid and late 30s, who want to start families and who have a lot to give to the country but haven't been able to because there's not the necessary market reforms that are necessary to get these people employed.
Right. And a lot of pundits are saying the way forward is to find someone new to shake up the welfare and business culture. The mayor of Florence, I gather, has been mentioned as a promising leader. I mean, is it really about just finding the one leader who can restore confidence in a system that seems broken?
I think Matteo Renzi, the 40-something mayor of Florence, offers a symbolic change that's important for this country, to bring in someone who's younger, who's energetic, who's dynamic, who now has the ear of the center-left party. It didn't a little while ago. Will one person solve all of Italy's problems? No. I mean, he's bound to disappoint, but at least it will signify a shift within Italian politics that's desperately needed.
Megan Williams in Rome, good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
There are lots of new ways to find the world, including our new digital home, PRI.org. One other great way is with the Flipboard app. Think radio becomes a magazine whose pages you can actually flip through and at the same time hear all the voices you know from the world. It's pretty cool, and it runs on your iPad, iPhone, or Android device. You can find that at flipboard.com/the world. Still ahead on the program, how much love is there still between Brazil and the U.S.? We'll hear the latest from Rio on the world from PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. For our GeoQuiz today, we're looking for a structure the writer George Orwell called one of the most hideous buildings in the world. Orwell might have been a bit unfair. That's because he never actually saw the finished product. It's been under construction for more than 100 years and still is to this day. the building we'd like you to name soars above the city of Barcelona. In a way, it seems to reach for heaven itself, and that's probably the point. The building is a church. Need more help? Well, the Catholic Church is the unfinished passion of Barcelona's most famous or infamous architect, Antoni Gaudí. People call him God's architect. He worked furiously on the building, altering plans, adding additions, and figuring out the most minute of details for decades. So what's the name of Gaudí's famous church? We'll give the answer in a few minutes. The headline for this next story could be Atheism Added to School Curriculum in Ireland. In fact, that is the headline. And in a country where the Catholic Church controls most public schools, that's big news. Now, here's the rub. The Irish elementary students who will now be taught about atheism are only those who attend multi-denominational schools, and they're just 7% of Irish school children. The rest go to public schools funded by taxpayers but run by the Catholic Church. Peter McGuire reports for the Irish Times. He's in Dublin. We need a little background here first, Peter. How is it that the Catholic Church controls more than 90% of public elementary schools in Ireland? I mean, here, separation of church and state would just make that a no-no.
Well, Ireland is definitely becoming more secular, but the church, since the Irish state became independent in 1922, did gain control of the primary school system. To some extent, they were providing resources that the state didn't have, and they also kind of wanted to consolidate their power. As Ireland has become more secular from about the 1990s, the Catholic Church control of primary school education has become more and more controversial.
So where is that influence felt? I mean, how much does Catholicism assert itself on, say, the curriculum in these elementary schools?
Catholicism asserts itself hugely on the curriculum. Just earlier this year, the Minister for Education pointed out that Irish elementary schools spend 2.5 hours per week on religious instructions. This compares to 1 hour for science and 1 hour for PE. So in Ireland, we spend about double the amount of time that other countries do on religion, and we spend much less time on science. So this is seen as something that really does need to change. And I think the government's intention is to change this. It's also felt, I suppose, in the communion and confirmation, which generally the preparation for that is given in schools, where I suppose in America they might have Sunday school where children are making their Catholic communion or Catholic confirmation. That preparation is done outside school hours. Here it's done inside school hours.
How new are the multi-denominational schools? And did they come about in response to the changing demographics in Ireland?
There have been multi-denominational schools for, I'd say, over 20 years, but they have grown massively over the past decade, particularly over the past number of years.
Is there a lot of competition among kids and parents to get into these multi-denominational schools?
Yes, there's a lot of competition to get those places. A lot of parents have to put their kids' names down early. There's huge demand for these multi-denominational schools, but like any, I suppose, institutional system, change happens slowly.
So what's the motivation behind this new instruction in atheism in those multi-denominational schools? Is it about kind of teaching children that God does not exist, or is it educating them about what options are out there, atheism being one of them?
It's very much about educating them about the different options that are out there. And it's not so much about teaching them to be atheists as teaching them about atheism and teaching them that it's another option. Like every Irish primary school, they have to include religious instruction. They just tend to probably include more about Catholicism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, and atheism now as well. So it's a new module. It'll be optional for some schools. Not all schools are going to have to take it.
Has there been any opposition to the teaching of atheism?
Not particularly, no. I suppose from the church's point of view, the Educate Together multi-denominational schools are free to do as they wish. If parents don't want their child taking part, well, then the parents can opt out. There's mixed feelings. There's some indifference, a lot of anger at the Catholic Church, particularly over the past couple of decades, given the abuse scandals. And then, of course, yes, some people who do still want their kids to have a Catholic education. So, no, there hasn't really been any opposition at all.
Peter McGuire reports on education for the Irish Times in Dublin. Thank you, Peter.
Okay.
In our GeoQuiz, we ask you for the unfinished masterpiece of architect Antoni Gaudí. It's one that George Orwell hated. Still, many others in the city of Barcelona have sworn to complete it, and they seem to be making good on that promise. The architects in charge of the task have just released an animated video showing the final stages of construction for the Sagrada Familia. and the Sagrada Familia, or the Church of the Holy Family, is the answer to our GeoQuiz. Now, I've never visited the Sagrada Familia, don't even know Barcelona, but the world's Bradley Campbell has been there. And tell us what the video shows, Bradley. How different might this church look from what I've seen in pictures in the present state?
You know, basically, we're seeing Gaudí's unfinished dream, or at least what the architects now in charge of the project believe is the best representation of that dream. Most plans for the building were destroyed during the Spanish Civil War at the end of the 1930s, so they're basing this completion off Gaudí's drawings and sketches of the place.
So it's this just already a gigantic, massive dedication to God, this church, and it looks like it's going to be twice the size of what it already is when it's completed in 2026. I mean, I can imagine if you're like 100 miles from Barcelona, you'd be able to see it.
Oh, for sure, for sure. It just really blows you away. I mean, much of it has to do with the surrounding structures. They're kind of short, so they make the building look much larger in comparison. But it seems like at all hours of the day, people are just standing outside just trying to get inside the church. There's this line that just snakes around the block. And, you know, the more you just think about this, the more you realize, like, man, they've been building this church for more than a century.
It's crazy. I mean, the scaffolding has been there the whole time.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like since the start, it's always been trying to just get up to go higher and higher and higher to just kind of reach heaven. And what's crazier still is then when you get inside, it feels like you've entered this Catholic dreamscape. You walk under what feels like a forested canopy of heaven. You know, it's just this real spiritual place for sure. And it kind of reaches out to everyone's spirit, not just a particular religion.
Right. So the spirituality that's kind of created by this architecture has actually made some people convert to Catholicism, I've heard.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I could see why. You know, when I first looked up at the building, the first words that came out of my mouth were, Jesus Christ. Now, joking aside, of course, one fascinating part of the building, it has nothing to do with the showy nature of the church itself, but really Gaudí's workspace. It's this little tiny hermetic basement. It was like this little cave where he had the power to basically construct the heavens right over his head.
So the architects are supposed to complete this, as I said, in 2026. I mean, will they actually get it done then?
You know, it's going to be interesting to see if they're going to be able to meet that deadline. You know, the church looked totally unfinished just a year or so ago when I visited. And then judging from the animation video, the hardest part is still to come. They need to complete the largest tower. It's known as the Christ Tower, and it's some 500 feet high. And then when the final piece is finally put in place, the Sagrada Familia, it should become the tallest church in the world.
And maybe then Antoni Gaudí can finally rest in peace. The world's Bradley Campbell, thanks for helping us with today's GeoQuiz.
Hey, you bet.
You have to see the video animation of the planned construction at La Sagrada Familia. It's crazy. 13 years of new towers and details going up one after the other. And like the whole history of the structure, it never seems to stop growing. Check it out at PRI.org. News headlines are coming up next. You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on the program, an imam in Turkey is gaining notoriety by preaching peace.
Everything is God. Everyone is God. And if I heart your heart, I heart God's heart. If we love each other, we will be very happy this life and the other life.
But his use of rock and roll isn't making the religious authorities happy.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. 9 months. Remember that time frame. That's how long the weapons inspectors who arrived in Syria today have to get their job done. The inspectors are supposed to be finished scrapping Syria's chemical weapons arsenal by mid-2014. Keep in mind that they're operating in a conflict zone, and as The World's Matthew Bell reports, that's not the only challenge they're facing.
The inspections process will start with verification. That means checking to see that Syria gave an honest declaration of its chemical stockpile. At the same time, inspectors will begin destroying Syria's ability to make more weapons. Former CIA advisor and weapons inspector Charles Dulfer says getting rid of chemical weapons or CW production equipment will be the easy part.
So the Syrian CW capability will be seriously degraded in the first month. in the next couple of weeks, I would imagine you'll be seeing the destruction of production equipment, you know, by being run over by bulldozers, basically running over equipment, just crushing it. And there'll be a video demonstrating this.
The regime in Damascus is adamant that it's serious about giving up its chemical weapons program. Spokeswoman Butaina Shaban says the government has been very cooperative.
It is the party that volunteered joining the Organization for Non-Proliferation of Chemical Weapons, and therefore all this rhetoric about forcing the Syrian government or making sure that the Syrian government, all this rhetoric in order to show as if Syria is not the one who wanted to do this.
Cooperation from the Syrian government will be critical for the inspectors to go about their work. Syria's foreign minister has said 7 out of 19 chemical weapons-related sites are located in combat zones. Before the inspections team can visit those areas, pro-government forces are going to have to work out a truce with whatever rebel groups might be active there. Without a doubt, Charles Dulfer says the security risks are the biggest challenge ahead.
Weapons inspectors have to visit various production sites, storage sites, to verify the declarations of Syria. The insurgents of whatever stripe may see this as an opportunity to disrupt the perhaps increasing legitimacy of the Bashar al-Assad regime. So there may be an incentive for the insurgents to either attack or otherwise disrupt this process.
The process was agreed on by the United Nations Security Council, and it's relying on inspectors from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, a group based in The Hague. They have never before attempted to dismantle a country's chemical stockpile in the middle of a war. OPCW spokesman Michael Lujan says the Syrians are fully complying so far.
They joined the convention in due course. They made a full disclosure to us on their chemical weapons program. When we needed to arrange visas, things of that nature, they responded immediately. So they, until now, have done everything to facilitate and enable OPCW to get on with the verification measures.
Lujan conceded that the timeline for completing the destruction of Syria's entire chemical weapons program by mid-next year is ambitious.
But it's our assessment that with full international cooperation, including the necessary financing, which is going to be needed for that, as well as full cooperation from the Syrian authorities, we do believe this is possible.
Possible, yes, but Charles Dulfer says the OPCW inspections team faces a bureaucratic challenge as well.
Diplomats and bureaucrats in The Hague or New York can write all the rules and regulations they want, but at the end of the day, it's the weapons inspectors and the chief weapons inspectors on the ground who will make key decisions. And the weapons inspector's counterpart, in this case the Syrian counterpart, they need to have a leader on the Syrian side who has authority and has the guidance to make this work.
In other words, who will be in charge on the ground, and will they be able to get along? For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Beyond the chemical weapons issue, another huge complicating factor in Syria is the presence of radical jihadi groups among the rebel ranks. Some of them have ties to al-Qaeda, and they've been gaining ground in recent months. Christoph Reuter is a reporter for the German newsweekly Der Spiegel. He's been reporting from the town of Atme near the Turkish border, a place where many foreign Islamist fighters have been gathering. Reuter describes it as a Disneyland for jihadists, a place with all the comforts of home, but without the risks found on the real front lines.
This combination of Atme with modest climate, houses, rather cheap houses for rent, 3 internet places, clothes shops specialized on jihadi outfits from Waziristan and Afghanistan, which together make a kind of club meet for jihadis who come to Syria not necessarily really to fight, but to tell all their friends at home, I'm a jihadi in Syria now.
You mentioned Pakistan and Egypt. Where else are these jihadists coming from?
Well, the biggest group is, to our great surprise, Tunisians, at least in Idlib. In Aleppo, it's mostly Saudis, Moroccans. Then you have Egyptians, Europeans like British or French, originating from Pakistan or from Algeria. You have Chechens. You have people from Dagestan. You have even Indonesians in some areas. So it seems to be a really international movement. You go to the provincial airport of Hatay in southern Turkey, and always you are standing in line with assortment of jihadis.
That is extraordinary. So are they actually doing any fighting, or are they just going out to eat?
We don't have precise numbers, but probably maybe 30-40% go to fight, and maybe a third or so they come to Syria, and then they stay in and around Atma, which started as an entry place, and they stayed. They have no intention of going anywhere. It was surreal.
That does mean, though, that 60 to 80% of the jihadists are serious fighters and ought to be of concern to both Syria and all the players involved in it right now.
See, what you have in Syria now is a kind of Faustian deal, a very weird deal between jihadists and the bigger rebel groups, that some of the jihadis, they really fight the regime. They offer the use of suicide bombers in some cases, and they are, militarily speaking, a real asset. But you have a large group of them which we encounter. What they want to do is basically impose their rule and their agenda on people in areas which have seen no fighting since half a year or 1 year, because they are deep, deep into the liberated area.
The presence, though, of al-Qaeda-affiliated rebel groups has been a key concern of those who are opposed to U.S. intervention in Syria. You're not saying that that concern is not justified?
No, the concern is absolutely justified. And when you talk to, let's say, Syrian rebel commanders from the main factions, they all give you the same answer. They say, we ask everybody for help. We ask Americans for help. We ask the Saudis for help. We ask Europe for help. The only people who came to help are jihadis from all over the Sunni world, like them, but we are not in a position to open a second front. The toppling of Assad would mean that you have another round of fighting, Syrians kicking out the foreign jihadis.
Christoph Reuter with the German news magazine Der Spiegel, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Brazil is not the first place you might think of if you were asked to name countries where folks can be hostile to the United States, but recent revelations have caused a spike in tension. Revelations that the U.S. government, through the NSA, has aggressively monitored the communications of both the Brazilian government and private Brazilian citizens. That led President Dilma Rousseff postponing a state dinner with President Obama. The tension was further highlighted over the weekend with a screening in Rio de Janeiro of the Richard Rowley documentary, Dirty Wars. The film follows journalist Jeremy Scahill as he travels the world talking to families and communities affected by what he calls America's assassination program, mostly via drone strikes. The documentary was shown at Rio's prestigious film festival and was followed by a panel discussion. Reporter Catherine Osborne went to the event and joins us now from Rio. What was the whole thing like, Catherine?
It was a very interesting scene. It was, to start with, it was very international. The film festival is the biggest in Latin America, and there were a lot of media at the event. People were interested in the discussion that was going to happen, and the tone was very serious. Everyone was attentive to the topics at hand, which were American strategy, both as depicted in the film and as recently written about in the press, Brazilian communications, and also sort of the role of journalism in explaining this and talking about its significance to the wider Brazilian public.
So what did you hear in that discussion? What kind of attitudes toward the United States were coming out?
It was opened by Scahill, the journalist and protagonist of the film, and Attila Hawk, who's the director of Amnesty International Brazil, and Glenn Greenwald. And so first they spoke a little bit about, you know, what are the implications of exposure of these activities by the U.S.? And they mentioned U.S. surveillance of Brazil. They mentioned Brazilian military policy towards its own citizens, which are having a moment of democratic protest right now, receiving some aggression from their police officials. And so Scahill and Greenwald spoke against that use of force. There were questions from the audience about U.S. reach and U.S. decision-making in this. In the questions, it was not a tone of anger or railing on. It was more, this is something serious that we need to look closely at what is policy like, what does it mean that the U.S. acts this way, and divulges that it acts certain ways. So I would say the tone was thoughtful and inquisitive, not outright angry, but very serious.
And Catherine, compare that serious tone you heard at that panel discussion at the screening of this documentary to what you've been hearing on the streets of Rio.
People are less likely today to announce praise for the United States in Brazil and in Rio on the streets. Certainly, I would say, you know, the person that you meet on the street is going to be in tone more aggressive. The tone of this discussion was more of an place of understanding. Let's look into this. What are the implications of this? But in both, I would say it's a critical perspective that the Brazilian public is taking right now.
And when you say more aggressive, give me an example.
Oh, there were signs during street protests on Brazilian Independence Day against U.S. military intervention in Syria. The word imperialist has been used by Brazilians in protest context against the United States. You know, as a reporter going up to people saying that you're an American journalist doesn't cause immediate respect and people wanting to talk to you in these situations. So a little bit of that.
I mean, culturally, I know there's a lot of cross-fertilization between Brazil and the U.S., but this does seem kind of new. Are Brazilians, like themselves, confused about how they're feeling about the U.S. right now?
A little bit. And I've had Brazilian peers say, oh, you know, the U.S. has, it's viewed differently in public opinion now as compared to how it was a month or two ago. There is still a huge cultural exchange between the two countries. So there's an ongoing interest in American culture and what's going on in the United States. At the same time, I would say that a hands-down Brazilian endorsement of anything American within Brazilian public opinion, that's at a different place now than it was 2 months ago.
Freelance reporter Catherine Osborne in Rio de Janeiro. Thanks so much for your time, Catherine.
Thank you, Marco.
Coming up on our program tomorrow, ever had trouble explaining to your mother what you do?
Yes, I was more fearful of what my family was going to say than what the others would say.
That's Yemeni photographer Bushra Al-Mutawakil.
My mother did eventually say something, saying to me that she found it extremely strange and odd that I would exhibit photos of myself and my daughter to the public. And then I was trying to say to her, but Mom, you know, it's a work of art. It's been exhibited here and there, and a museum purchased it. And my mother said, she found that even worse. Like, who on earth would sell work of themselves and their daughter? Yeah, it's just unheard of.
Bushra Al-Mutawakil's life story and her photography tomorrow on The World. Let's circle back to the shutdown now before the break. A group of World War II veterans arrived in Washington today to pay their respects to fallen comrades. They found the entrance to the National World War II Memorial barred and marked with signs announcing the shutdown. Well, it seems men who couldn't be stopped by Hitler and kamikazes couldn't be stopped by something like that. It's not clear what happened exactly, but the barriers came down and the ancient warriors got in and did their thing. A short way away, a group of Puerto Rican veterans did the same thing at the Korean War Memorial. Well, that's one way to handle the shutdown. This is The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't trust Iran or its new president, and he made that clear today at the UN General Assembly.
Ahmadinejad was a wolf in wolf's clothing. Rouhani is a wolf in sheep's clothing, a wolf who thinks he can pull the wool over the eyes of the international community.
That seems to be the general feeling in Israel, but here's another perspective on Iran from Israel. It belongs to the host of a Persian language show on Israeli radio, which Iranians listen to by bypassing government restrictions. Reporter Daniel Estrin has our story.
Injo Shalim Sedoye Israel.
Every Sunday, Menashe Amir sits in a studio at Israel's state radio station. He puts on his headphones, gets real close to the mic, and poses a question to his Iranian listeners.
This Sunday, we ask whether you believe Rouhani or not.
He asks callers to dial a German phone number he set up that directs their calls straight to the studio in Israel. It's a way to get around the Iranian ban on calling Israeli numbers. And he also asks callers not to say their names or their hometowns so they don't get in trouble. One caller says Rouhani has every right to continue the country's nuclear program. But Amir says most of the other callers, like this one, think Rouhani is being kept on a tight leash.
He says that I believe that there is a kind of cooperation and coordination between Rouhani and Khamenei and the Revolutionary Guards. They give him the orders and he doesn't have the full authority.
Many of his Iranian callers have made that point, Amir says.
Most of the people who entered our broadcast, they don't believe in Rouhani. And if he has changed his tone, it's just because the regime in Iran is in a very bad economic shape from the international community. So they have to be nice to the others.
But he says the baby steps Iran and the U.S. are making toward each other also have his callers hopeful.
They love the American music. They love the American culture. The United States is considered in their eyes as a symbol of progress and a good life. And they want to be like America.
It's kind of strange that ordinary Iranians would confide in a radio host from their arch enemy, Israel. But Menashe Amir has a few things going for him. He grew up in Iran. And he's been hosting this show for more than 50 years. Iranians have known for decades that when they want to speak their mind, they can call into the show.
Very frequently, the Iranian governmental media, they accuse us of spreading lies in Iran.
Amir smiles when he says that, because he loves the fact that Iran's leaders are actually listening. He says even Khomeini, the founder of the Iranian Revolution, reportedly tuned in. Whether or not that's true, Menashe Amir says he's sure other Iranian movers and shakers are listening. And he gets senior Israeli politicians to come on the show, too. Iran has no dialogue with Israel like Iran has begun with the U.S. But if or when Iran's leaders want to start the conversation, they know what show to call. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin, Har Adar, near Jerusalem.
Finally today, a story from Turkey about an imam who rocks, literally. The imam is the prayer leader in a mosque, and this one started a band with some veteran headbangers. And their mix of Sufi mysticism and acid rock is raising eyebrows. Big surprise. Jacob Resnick reports from Kosh, Turkey.
42-year-old Ahmet Tuzer chants the azan, the Islamic call to prayer, from his small mosque in the village of Pinarbasha. It's a small whitewashed building serving a village of about 14 households that sit on a hillside above the idyllic town of Kosh on Turkey's Mediterranean coastline. For the past 15 years, Tuzer has worked as one of about 100,000 imams in Turkey, all state employees who work in government-run Sunni mosques. But it's his evening hobby that's been attracting attention. Combining Sufi mysticism with the music of his heroes like Pink Floyd and Queen, Tuzer says he wants to spread a message of peace, love, and tolerance.
Everything is God. Everything is God. Everyone is God. We believe that. And if I heart your heart, I believe that I heart God's heart. If we love each other, we will be very happy this life and the other life.
This summer, Tuzer met some other musicians in town. They decided to collaborate and create the band Fi Rock, a play on a mystical mathematical formula for creating patterns that are aesthetically pleasing. But this group isn't just a band of amateurs' attempt at spreading peace and love. The guitarist, Dohan Sirkin, has played with some big names in Turkish rock. With his long gray hair and tattoos up his arms and legs, this aging rocker is a veteran stage performer. Sirkin says psychedelic rock will extend the imam's peaceful message to those who wouldn't normally be exposed to Islamic mysticism.
Why play rock? Well, sure, we could play ney and bendir, traditional Turkish instruments, but that wouldn't attract much attention. It would be too traditional and it wouldn't work. But because rock is so universal, that's what we went with.
Fi Rock played its first concert to about 1,000 people in the town of Kosh. It got a warm reception at the show, but not everyone in the community was pleased. Tuzer says he received insults and even threats on social media.
Radical Islamic public, they don't like my music, my stuff, because they cannot understand my opinion, but this is normal.
Turkey's religious directorate is also investigating the imam. Earlier this month, Tuzer said the regional office announced it had opened a probe into what's likely the first ever rock and roll imam. In the city of Antalya, Ahmet Çelik is the mufti in charge of the mosques of the region, which includes Kash. Çelik says his office is looking into Tuzer's activities. There are rules, he says, about what kinds of commercial activities imams are allowed to engage in. We've got investigators looking into what Tuzer's doing, he says, to see if it's a commercial activity. And not only that, we have certain common values in the religious directorate, and we're trying to determine if Tuzer's music violates these rules. Firak is in the midst of producing an album, so it's unclear whether a commercial release would run afoul of these religious authorities. In the meantime, the group's ambitions are far-reaching, with the aim of carving out a new genre, that of Islamic rock. Tuzer says Islamist radicals have tarnished his face image in many ways. His aim, he says, is to show that that's not the full story.
Islam is peaceful, Islam is respect, Islam is law, everything. Islam is moral, and beautiful moral. We want to live like that.
Turkey's society remains polarized between the more religiously conservative and secular-minded people who listen to Western-style music. Tuzer and his bandmates say they hope to bridge that gap. For The World, I'm Jacob Resnick, Kosh, Turkey.
I don't know if the Rockin' Imam wants his MTV, but he does have a music video, and we've got it for you at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. The Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. And by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.